Marshall, please call the next case.
Your Honor, this is case number A210848, State of Minnesota versus Aaron Morris Swenson.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome again to the Minnesota Court of Appeals on Wednesday, March 23rd. We are about to hear the last case scheduled for oral argument this morning. And I appear before you with, or I'm here with you, with Judges Lucinda Jessen and Judge Jeffrey Bryan. I am Sarah Wheelock, and we are holding the hearing this morning via zoom.gov. So I'm going to address a few matters before we begin. These oral arguments are recorded by the court. The audio recordings for this are generally available within 24 hours on the Court of Appeals page on the Judicial Branch's website. I also note that our appellate rules prohibit anyone from making a recording, audio, or video of the oral argument here unless you have received the court's permission at least 24 hours in advance and you have agreed to comply with the specific conditions set forth by the Minnesota Supreme Court. Counsel, as you probably know, you will each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you look at your computer screens, there should be a blue square in the upper left-hand corner with the clock. I recommend that you keep that visible to yourself so you can see what time you have left. And also that when not speaking, that you place yourself on mute, but leave your video on. When you begin, please introduce yourself and identify the party who you are representing. And finally, if you run into any issues with the technology, please let me know because we will stop and address that issue before we move on because we do want to hear from all of you here today. So with that, counsel for appellant, please begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Sarah Martin. I represent the appellant, Aaron Swenson. Mr. Swenson was found guilty following a jury trial of first, second, third, and fifth degree assault and was sentenced on the count of first degree assault. Mr. Swenson raises two issues on appeal, whether the delay in bringing him to trial violated his right to a speedy trial and whether the evidence was sufficient to convict him of first degree assault. First, I'd like to address the sufficiency of the evidence. The evidence was insufficient to convict Mr. Swenson of first-degree assault because Mr. Johnson's injuries did not amount to great bodily harm. There is no dispute about Mr. Johnson's injuries in this case. He had red marks on his neck. He had a slightly elevated pulse and a slightly elevated temperature. This is not great bodily harm. The relevant portion of the great bodily harm definition here is bodily injury that creates a high probability of death. Case law and the plain language of the statute make clear that the focus is on the injury that occurred and not on the acts of the defendant. The case law is also clear that the injury must be greater than the one sustained here in order to be great bodily harm. If you look at the cases that are cited in the briefs, Dye, Gerald, and Galley, in all of those cases, the injuries were far more significant than the injury here and still did not amount to great bodily harm. In Dye, the victim was shot through the back. The bullet traveled 8 inches through his abdomen. And the state had argued that it was a life-threatening injury because if the trajectory had been different, the bullet could have struck vital organs. But this was not sufficient. It was not sufficient because the victim did not actually sustain a life-threatening injury. In Gerald, the victim's throat was cut near a major vein and artery, and if either of those had been severed, the victim could have bled to death. Again, that was not great bodily harm. The fact that the injury could have been more serious is not sufficient to satisfy the statute. In Galley, the victim was pulled out of a car in a road rage incident, repeatedly kicked in the head like a soccer ball. He lost consciousness. He suffered concussion symptoms for 4 weeks and he had a fractured tibia. That was not great bodily harm. Again, the fact that the injuries could have been more serious or even life-threatening was not sufficient to support a finding of great bodily harm where the actual injuries themselves did not rise to that level of severity.
Ms. Martin,
yes.
if I can jump in just to clarify, you could frame this issue as one of statutory interpretation or one of applying some statutory label to these specific facts. And it seemed that there were portions of your brief and your reply brief where that's the way that you were framing it, asking for a different standard of review than the sufficiency of the evidence that you're arguing now. I guess that's my question, if you could clarify. I do think that to the extent there was statutory interpretation required, perhaps those previous cases, Dye, and I can't remember if it's Gerald or Gerard, whichever, those previous cases may have done that work already. So I guess I'm asking you to put you on the spot and tell me if this is sufficiency of the evidence or statutory interpretation.
It's a mix of both. And actually, this court's decision in Galley, even though it's non-precedential, does go through the analysis of when you apply the standard sufficiency of the evidence and when you apply de novo review. There are numerous cases that have cited or applied de novo review to sufficiency cases where the courts are determining whether undisputed facts meet the statute. And it's very consistent with the principle that questions of law are reviewed de novo. I would note, though, that even if this court applies the general sufficiency standard of review, the result would be the same.
Right. Well, before I get back to that, I just want to make sure. It seems like the statutory interpretation question is, do you need evidence of actual injury or possible injury? And like I said, I think that question's been answered. And so to the extent that we are applying a requirement that there be evidence of actual injury, what would be the two different interpretations of the statute that we're choosing from? Or is this really sufficiency of the evidence at that point?
Your Honor, I don't think that for a question of statutory interpretation, there needs to be two separate definitions to choose from. The question here, and it was made clear by the Supreme Court, and for example, in Pocknuck, which I'm probably pronouncing wrong, but it's cited in the reply brief. The question is, when you apply undisputed facts to a statute, that is a question of statutory interpretation. So it's not necessarily that there needs to be some ambiguity in the statute or two definitions that we're choosing between. It's really the question of law is, do the facts in the case meet the statute? So we would be applying in this case, for example, if there was a dispute, if there were two different experts testifying about whether an injury was life-threatening, for example, then we'd be applying the typical sufficiency of the evidence standard. But where there's no dispute of fact, there's no dispute about what the injuries were in this case. It's just a question of, do the undisputed facts meet the statute? That's a question of statutory interpretation that's reviewed de novo.
Thank you.
The state suggests that there's a high likelihood of death during the time that Mr. Johnson was held underwater. But there's no support for that argument that we look at the injuries during the act, and the state does not cite any authority for that. And to find in favor of the state on that ground would be a departure from well-established case law. Gerald provides an excellent example. The victim's erratic driving while the assailant had held a knife at the victim's neck would have created a high probability of death during the incident, but that's not the inquiry. Gerald makes very clear that the inquiry is, what were the injuries that were actually inflicted in the case? The state is really just asking this court to look at the act constituting the offense and make a finding of great bodily harm on grounds that the injuries could have been worse. This has been rejected, and this is in violation of the plain language of the statute. The injuries actually sustained in this case were minor. Mr. Johnson did not even require a pain reliever at the hospital. His care was mostly diagnostic. The evidence was insufficient to establish great bodily harm, and Mr. Swenson asks this court to reverse his first degree assault conviction. Mr. Swenson was also deprived of his right to a speedy trial. To determine whether a defendant's right to a speedy trial was violated, this court considers four factors: the length of the delay, the reason, whether the defendant asserted his right, and prejudice. delay in bringing Mr. Swenson to trial in this case was 216 days from the date of arrest and 191 days from the demand of a speedy trial. Relying on footnote 14.
Ms. Martin,
yes.
If I can jump in, maybe you can respond to the argument that there is case law that says you start the clock at the time of the plea, the entered a not guilty plea, which is not the same as the way you've argued we should start the clock.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's the state is relying on footnote 14 and in Mikkel and asking the court to calculate the delay from Mr. Swenson's second demand on October 5th. The state omits, though, the next paragraph in the footnote, which explains that the state's argument is misplaced, and it reaffirms that the triggering event for a speedy trial right is the initiation of prosecution, arrest or charging, whichever occurs first. And the Minnesota Supreme Court made that clear as well in State versus Jones, which is cited in the brief. It didn't matter in Mikkel because there was a presumption of prejudice either way under either counting. And in this case, really, as far as the presumption of prejudice goes, it doesn't matter. We're well beyond the 60 days for a presumption of prejudice, no matter how this court calculates it. The cases that talk about the triggering event are cases that solely interpret Rule 1109 of the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure. And that is different from the triggering event under the Constitution for a speedy trial right. In this case, there's multiple reasons for the delay, but only 14 of the 216-day delay is attributable to the defense. If this court determines that this case turns on the COVID delay, then Page, which is going to be argued on April 7th, will be dispositive of the issue. But as I argued in the brief, this case is distinguished from both Page and Jackson for several reasons. Most importantly, that not all of the delay in this case was due to COVID. The first trial was scheduled more than 60 days after he made his demand, and there's no reason for that in the record. The first continuance of four continuances was for 4 weeks due to an ill witness, and there's no reason stated in the record why that could have why that delay could have been shorter, couldn't have been shorter. It's also significant here that Mr. Swenson requested an exemption from the moratorium, and which the court denied without sending it up to the chief judge of the district. And then last, the last delay was due to LaVon Johnson's illness. And this was not good cause for a continuance. LaVon Johnson did not have any relevant testimony to provide at trial. Every single thing that she testified to could have been brought in through other witnesses. Mr. Swenson repeatedly asserted his right to a speedy trial. And to assess this factor, the court considers the frequency and force of the demand. And Mr. Swenson was both frequent and forceful in his demands. He requested a speedy trial at every hearing, every time the trial was continued, and in a letter requesting an exemption from the moratorium. Mr. Swenson was also prejudiced by the delay. And it's important to note here that prejudice is presumed. Mr. Swenson does not have to affirmatively prove prejudice. It is up to the state to rebut the prejudice, and the state has not and cannot do that. The state suggests there's no prejudice because Mr. Swenson also had a hold from the Department of Corrections, but Mr. Swenson's repeated request for lowering bail suggests that this offense was the reason that he was in custody. Balancing all of the factors here with the-
If I can go back for a moment to that hold, do you know when that was put in place?
Excuse me, the moratorium?
No, the DOC hold. When we're talking about prejudice, if he's in custody on some other matter, I just want to hear from you about when, if you know it, that other matter, the hold was put in place.
He was on supervised release at the time of this incident. So I believe that the hold would have been put on as soon as he was arrested or charged. But the process is, and this court is probably familiar with it, is that the defendant would make bail on the charged offense and then go to a DOC hearing in order to be released from that hold. So he was unable to do that because he had he couldn't make bail in the case that was pending.
Is there any authority that requires that sequence to play out in that way?
I don't know if there is an authority that specifically states that. It is just how it is done. So balancing all of the factors with the presumption of prejudice, it's clear that Mr. Swenson's right to a speedy trial was violated. The cases that the state cites in paragraph balancing the factors are either inapposite or not useful. In Cororito, there was no analysis whatsoever. In Cham, the defense did not request a speedy trial, and the bulk of the delay, the 15-month delay, was due to finding him an interpreter.
Ms. Martin, I'm sorry to interrupt. If I can just address Mr. Smith for a moment. You're very expressive, and it seems like you're reacting many times to some of the things Ms. Martin is saying, and it might be better just to listen and let her finish. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. In Givens, the delay was due to the defendant actually committing a bank robbery while he was out on bail for the pending charge, and then trial actually commenced within a month of his speedy trial demand. So balancing all of the factors in this case, Mr. Swenson was deprived of his right to a speedy trial, and his conviction must be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. We'll allow the marshal to get the clock ready and set for our respondent. And now, counsel for respondent, we turn to you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith. I represent the respondent state of Minnesota in this appeal. Judge Bryan, I want to address your concern. I was actually having difficulties hearing Ms. Martin several times during her argument. So to the extent that I was reacting, I think mostly I was reacting because I was just trying to strain to understand. So to the extent that provided a distraction to the court, I'm sorry for that. Appellant makes two arguments. First, he argues that his constitutional right to a speedy trial was violated. Second, he argues that the evidence was insufficient to sustain his first degree assault conviction. Appellant is wrong on both counts, and respondent respectfully asks this court to affirm appellant's conviction. I believe that the state's arguments regarding the first issue, the speedy trial issue, are adequately set forth in the state's brief. And unless the members of the court have questions for me about that issue, which I'm happy to entertain, I intend to focus my time on the question of the sufficiency of the evidence to support appellant's first degree assault conviction.
Mr. Smith, if you could go back to the speedy trial issue when it comes to the argument regarding a distinction between interpreting Rule 11.09 and the Constitution, or the constitutional requirement, especially as it relates to when the clock starts?
Well, as I understand the appellant's argument, he's arguing that it's not the delay from the time he was charged to the time he was brought to trial, but it's the time he entered his demand under rule, which would be under Rule 11, and the time he was brought to trial. That's my understanding of his argument. And in that regard, I think footnote 14 of Mikkel is dispositive of that issue because it clearly, the footnote clearly agrees with the argument that the state's argument that the triggering mechanism for the delay between the time of a demand and the time of trial is triggered by the timeline in Rule 11, which is the time when the defendant enters a plea. That's the first time a defendant can make a demand for a speedy trial. And that's my understanding of the appellant's argument, is that he's arguing that the delay from the time of his demand to the time of trial is violative. And I also think, even to the extent, and I conceded in my brief that the time from the demand after the entry of plea of guilty to the time of trial is sufficient to trigger the analysis, but it still makes a difference because of the way you count the numbers of days and the number of days of delay and who they may or may not be attributable to. That's particularly clear given the fact that appellant's counsel just argued about all of the time incorporated into her argument, the time before the omnibus hearing, before the defendant entered a plea, into the initial delay. And the case law that counts from the time of the demand to the time of the trial doesn't count time before you can properly make a demand under the rule against the state. But appellant's trying to attribute that time against the state, arguing that he made a demand earlier, but he couldn't make the demand earlier. So appellant hasn't argued that the time from charging to the time of, as I understand the appellant's argument, to the time of trial is the issue. He's instead focused his argument on the time of demand to the time of trial. And therefore the footnote in Mickel is appropriate and is controlling. And so I think that that's certainly relevant here. Moreover, as long as we're talking about the length of the delay, appellant has argued that the time where between the initial trial date being continued because the emergency room doctor was unavailable, which was within 60 days of the appellant's demand, by the way. The original trial date was within 60 days of his demand. So I think that's particularly noteworthy here. It's arguing that that delay from that original trial date to the next trial date, which was still within 60 days of the demand, should be attributed against the state. But in Mickel, the Supreme Court specifically said that when there is good cause for a delay, such as the unavailability of a key witness of the state for unavoidable reasons, that delay cannot be held against the state. And appellant has not argued that the treating physician who necessitated that initial continuance was not a key witness and was not unavoidably unavailable. So attributing that portion of the delay to the state isn't appropriate. Mickel says as much. And when you start excluding periods of delay, and the delay due to COVID also can't be attributed against the state here, what we end up with, I think, at most, even if you grant the appellant's contention that LJ was an unnecessary witness, which of course the district court disagreed with, we're left with 44 days of delay attributable to the state.
So, Mr. Smith, if I may, just given the diminishment of time, the limited time we have here, I would like to turn to the sufficiency issue. And, you know, I don't see how we accept the state's position without overruling the Gerald case, if not Dye. And I read in your brief, you're saying, oh, but those are different. It was a moment in time injuries versus some continuous injury. I don't see how that changes the analysis other than say, well, this is factually different. So could you help me with that? And also while you're answering that, you would agree that if we hung our hat on this continuous harm versus moment in time, that we would be saying that this court's decision, although unprecedented in Gali, was wrong. So could you address that for me?
So yes, I'll try to address that as best as I can. And I think to start with, I think we need to remember an important admission from appellant's list of the injuries that the victim sustained, which is a loss of consciousness during the process of being choked and drowned. The evidence shows that the victim lost consciousness while being choked in the river, and then after that was again subjected to being held under the water to the point where he could no longer hold his breath and had to start swallowing water in an attempt to not inhale it. To suggest that loss of consciousness and that kind of drowning are themselves not injuries, I think it loses sight of what constitutes an injury. The argument here seems to stem around an injury must be something that you can see later.
Well, doesn't Dye say that the victim did not suffer great bodily harm because the in part the victim didn't testify about permanent pain or permanent scarring?
With regard to that, I would say we have to look at the structure of the definition of great bodily harm. And we're in the first phrase here, which is bodily injury, which creates a high probability of death. It doesn't have to be a permanent probability. The idea that permanent applies here is inconsistent with the plain language of the statute.
But if you read the statute, it then says, which causes serious permanent disfigurement or which causes a permanent or protracted impairment.
And if you look at the structure there, it's bodily injury, which or other. There are four different clauses here that have to be given independent effect. And the first three are specific. And the fourth is, I think the case law has suggested, maybe a catch-all. Now, I want to point out right now, what we're having is an argument about statutory interpretation, but that is not the argument that the appellant has made here. And I think that ties into the argument and Judge Bryan's question about the appropriate standard of review. And appellant's reliance on Pakenyuk, Rick, and Litzel are completely inappropriate. And appellant's argument here would expand the scope of review in every criminal case to de novo review as to whether the elements are satisfied. Pakenyuk involved an actual dispute about the meaning of the statute, which was resolved by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court then, after determining what the statute meant, asked whether the evidence that was adduced at trial was sufficient, and in a one-line sentence, concluded that it was.
So, Mr. Smith, if you could come back and answer my question, part of my question, and I apologize for asking multiple questions before, but one of my questions was, if we adopted your interpretation and reading of the Gerald case, that we would be saying our recent non-presidential case in State versus Golly was wrong. I mean, is that fair?
I'm not sure that that's fair, because what that's not the way I understand Golly. I know.
Well, there was like a concussion, right?
Yes.
You know, and I think that he was in and out of consciousness for a while at the wreck, and then there was a concussion, but there was more ongoing. It wasn't one of your like point in time, the gunshot, right?
And the way I would explain, and I tried to answer this, but maybe I didn't do it well or clearly. I think when you couple the loss of consciousness, which we know constitutes substantial bodily harm at the very least, and I think the Supreme Court has left open the question of whether that might be great bodily harm. If we combine that with the subsequent shortened time, near drowning, because I mean, drowning, I think that's the difficulty here, is we're dealing with this, some might call it a mechanism of injury, but I think it also causes injury itself. And so you've got this act that's going on, that's drowning, that causes injury. And the scale is so narrow between permanent brain damage or death. And you seem to be just fine, that when you couple that with the fact that he'd already been choked to unconsciousness, those facts give the jury a sufficient basis to find the defendant caused great bodily harm. And I think, to a certain extent, if I can again ground this in the standard of review, to the extent that the court's wrestling with how is this minutely different from this other unpublished case, I think it suggests that maybe we've gotten the standard of review off a little bit, because what we're trying to do is, quite frankly, after the fact, second guess jury determinations. If we were asking instead, does this evidence provide the jury with a sufficient basis to reasonably conclude, as we do under the normal sufficiency of the evidence standard of review, then I think when we look at that through the eyes of a jury, through the eyes of the burden of proof and the instructions that a jury is given, we can say that a juror's applying their common sense can reasonably say that when you choke somebody to unconsciousness and then hold them under the water past a point where they can hold their breath, that's an injury that causes a high probability of death.
So, Mr. Smith, though, okay, so setting aside Dolly, what about State versus Dye? That was a case where we had an abdominal gunshot wound, and this court looked at that, I believe, after a conviction of first-degree assault with great bodily harm, and reversed it there. I mean, how does that fit into your standard of review analysis that you just gave us?
Well, I think that to the extent that there has been a trend in the appellate courts, and I'm not saying that it's just the Court of Appeals. I think the Supreme Court has to a certain extent muddied the waters on this on occasion, to review the question of whether after a jury trial, certain harm meets a statutory definition de novo, feeds into this problem. And that might not be satisfactory to the court, but I think there is a real substantial analytical problem that's going on here that feeds into this. And I think the other thing is the bullet went where the bullet went. And after the fact, we can see that. Right. The fact is, science can't tell you exactly what was going on in the victim's body. Well, he was being held under the water to the point where he couldn't hold his breath anymore. That's the time when an injury, I would submit it's a temporary injury here that happened. And it's not something that is subject to measurement in the way that bullet wounds and their trajectories are. That, I think, is the difference, Your Honor. My time has expired. I would simply ask the court to affirm the appellant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. And now we'll turn to appellant for the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, just to clarify on the speedy trial violation, this has been raised as a constitutional violation, not merely a violation under the rule. So this court should be applying the constitutional standard. The second issue I would like to address is the argument regarding the loss of consciousness while underwater. I would argue again that this would be a departure from well-established case law and a departure from the plain language of the statute. What the state is really arguing here is that this injury could have been worse. The injuries could have been worse in Gerald, in Gali, and in Dye. In Gali, there was a beating at the intersection. This was a process that went on for a period of time. The victim was left apparently unconscious for a short period of time in the intersection. That would have created a high likelihood of death during the incident as it was occurring, similar to the state's argument in this case. But in Gali, this court did not determine that there was a high likelihood of death based upon that. This court did what it has done in other cases, what the plain language of the statute instructs the court to do, which is look at the injury that was actually inflicted in the case. And unless there are other questions, I would just ask this court to reverse Mr. Swenson's convictions. Thank you.
If I could ask a question, since there is additional time here. When we're looking at the Barker factors, and we are looking at different reasons for the period of delay, and it doesn't appear that there are multiple reasons for the same period of delay. Like each period of delay, you can kind of separate from the others. When we're working our way through those factors, is it your belief that we look at the totality of them and say, okay, well, for most of those delays, it's this, but there's one that goes the other way, and then move on? Or is it your understanding that Under the second factor, we say, okay, these were, let's say, the unavoidable, unavoidably unavailable witness, that we're not going to hold that against the state. So we're not even going to look at the next factor when it comes to that issue. We just sequence them in such a way that the only ones we get to factors three and four are the ones that we need to look at, or do you look at it holistically?
I don't know that the case law specifically answers that question. I would agree with the state that at least a period of time should not be considered against the state regarding Dr. Freeze's unavailability. But there has to be some limit on how long a continuance can occur. If the continuance has been for 6 months, for example, based upon a brief illness.
Ms. Martin, Yes, sorry, ma'am. Could you repeat what you were saying? I think we might have all lost audio for a few seconds there.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think that the case law specifically answers that question about whether you consider the delay in the totality. I would agree that a period of time following Dr. Freeze's unavailability due to the fact that he had COVID should not be considered against the state. But there should be a limit, and there's no reason that the delay had to be 4 weeks. At least there's no reason provided in the record why they couldn't have started trial 2 weeks later, for example. There has to be a limit on how long of an extension or a continuance can be given before it starts counting again against the state. I guess is the argument that I'm making on that. To answer Judge Bryan's question more directly, I think that we look to the totality of the total time of the delay, but of course, any time that is a good cause delay should not be considered against the state. Thank you.
All right, thank you so much. Thanks to both counsel today for your arguments and your briefing. This has been helpful, and we will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within 90 days. That ends this morning's calendar, and the court is in recess.